Oh, Shazam. I was hoping they'd turn the lights way down low. So my name is Marita, and I am an alcoholic. Hi, gang. And there goes my cane. Oh. I just want to tell you how honored I am to be here. You guys are my people. You know, they say that when you come to AA, you find your family. And for me, when I go to meetings, I see all my cousins. I see my aunts and uncles and some of the crazy uncles. You know, they're all there. But when I come to PRASA, I see my brothers and my sisters. You know, you guys are my family. Scott and Nancy and I have been traveling together for a very long time. We all served as panel 99 delegates, 49 delegates. But that means it's 1999. So, like, I know a lot of you hadn't quit drinking in 1999, but we've been coming to PRASA ever since on our own dime because you guys are that important. You do is so important. And so for me to stand here with you is probably an honor I'll never forget. So thank you, Kunani. Thank you for inviting me. You know, somebody asked me, a lot of people asked me what I'm going to talk about tonight, and I said, I got no idea. Because this is different. Yes, you get my regular story, but I hope you get a lot of other things, and I say I hope because I'm hoping God shows up and then we'll hear what we're supposed to hear. So let me just start. I was the oldest daughter, which means child number 3 of 4, growing up, born and raised in Philadelphia. I should start with my sobriety date so that you don't have to calculate all these things. My current sobriety date is November 1, 1981. My home group is the Caring and Sharing Group in Mesquite, Nevada, which is about 90 miles past any length in Nevada. And so I grew up in this family, and my brothers' names are Bill and Bob. I also have a sister, and her name is Barb. My name does not start with B. I was 4 years old by the time I decided that I didn't belong to this family, that I must have been adopted, that everybody's name started with B except for mine. Of course, later I realized William and Robert were their names, but at 4, I already knew I don't belong, I'm different, I don't know how to fit in with this group. Hide. That was my first response, just hide. And so I kind of tried to stay under the radar. I lived in a neighborhood that was lovingly referred to as Hanukkah Heights. It was a Jewish neighborhood. I'm Irish Catholic. There was another Irish Catholic family in the neighborhood, but guess what? Guess who didn't feel like she fit in again? You know? They got to have a whole different set of holidays than I got. You know, they got parties when I didn't get them. I mean, they turned 13 and got parties. I didn't get a party when I didn't get parties, period, but I didn't get those. You know, I just went through life cataloging all the ways that I was different and didn't fit. It's just how my mind works. Who knows if I was born that way? I just know that's how I processed my life. I could tell you about my family. It wasn't the best. It wasn't alcoholic. It just wasn't a really great experience. But that's not why I'm alcoholic. Because I have 3 other siblings and none of them are alcoholic. So I can't blame my family experience. So I go through life trying to find a way to make it look like I fit in when I don't. And so, I don't know how many of you guys did this, but I was on the peripheral of every group I belonged to, right on the edge, never part of, but never out either. And that's how I went through life. And I was comfortable there because nobody was paying attention to me, which is why it's so hard to stand here. So what happens when you do that is you became a shapeshifter. You know, I was whatever I thought the people around me thought I should be at the moment. So, like, I hung out with the kids that were real partiers, and I was a partier. I went to church on Sunday with all the churchgoers and knew all the songs and sang in the choir. You know, whatever it took to make it look like I fit. One of these great adventures when I was 13 was I belonged to an activity after school, and we had to ride a bus to the activity. And I had two friends, all girls Catholic school, two friends, and we were sitting in the back of the bus because, you know, it's close enough to hear everything, but not close enough to be in it. And so we're sitting on the back of the bus, and Gail pulls out this bottle of wine, and she says, "Hey, we're going to drink today." You know, I've never drank anything in my life. But I was set up for that moment because I know how to get along. I know how to do whatever you're doing so it looks like I belong even when I don't. So Gail takes a drink, then Judy takes a drink, then I take a drink. Then Judy takes a drink, then Gail takes a drink, then Judy takes a drink, and I thought, I want to sit in the middle next time. That's my definition of alcoholism. I'm not even drunk yet, and I already know I want twice as much. I need to sit in the middle. And, you know, I can remember, like a lot of people do, that very first drink. When it goes down, and oh, I didn't know that I was going through life two drinks shy to be okay. But that's what I was. By the time that second one went down, I felt good. I felt like I belonged, I was part of. You know the story, we've all done it. It's what makes us feel okay. No point did I think, I don't like the taste of it. Never. I don't remember what it tasted like. I remember what happened to me and how I felt. Nothing mattered then, nothing at all. I was fine, the world was fine. So we drank that bottle and we went on our way that afternoon. And I decided that instead of Judy being my best friend, Gail was now my new best friend. And I tried to find alcohol every chance I could, every way I could. My family was pretty physical growing up, and so I learned how to live under the radar. And so one of the things I discovered when I drank was, if I'm on the honor roll and I'm doing everything I'm supposed to be doing, nobody's going to be checking what else I'm doing. And so that was my goal in high school, was to be as perfect as possible so that what I did with my off time was my own. And that's the way I drank. I drank as often as I could, when I could, where I could, didn't matter what it was, I just wanted more. You'd think in high school, you'd think, well, that, I don't, you know, you don't really need to drink. Never crossed my mind. And it wasn't until I was 5 years sober that it didn't cross my mind that most 13-year-olds don't drink. That if you're already doing that, there might be a problem. But that was who I was. Well, because I did so well in school, they offered me a scholarship to go to out-of-town college. And having born and raised in Philadelphia, and when Chicago called and said they'd like to have me come there, I was ready to go. Because I had created enough havoc in enough of these pockets that I was starting to act more like me, under the influence, than I was the people around me. And so I'm constantly trying to change my groups of people so they fit how I am when I'm drinking rather than who I was when I wasn't. So I say, oh, I would love to go to Chicago because I think I'm going to get a brand new start. You know, I graduated early. I was a little over 16. So I have a relative in this city, which was why my parents would let me go. And so my uncle had my mother and I out. Well, we looked at the college. And one of the first things he did was he came out with these beautiful wine glasses. You know, I'm 16, maybe 15 still at that point. And he hands them to us. And he gives me a wink, and my mother goes, "Oh my God, you're not giving Marita anything to drink." He said, "Of course not. She has grape juice." And he had given my mother the grape juice and me the wine. I knew I was going to love Chicago. No doubt about it. At the end of my freshman year, I'm so old that they did things differently back then. At the end of my freshman year, they sent a letter home to my parents, not me, saying, "Congratulations, your daughter's made the dean's list, da 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 da." And they were really happy. And then the next day, the second letter came, and it said, "Well, the behavior is really an issue. She can't get home on time. She's drunk a lot." All this. And so their theory was that they would, like, put me on probation for a semester. Well, I like to look good. I don't want to look like the guy on probation. And so there was this guy that I had been seeing my freshman year of college, and he followed me back to Philadelphia. And then my parents said, "Well, we're not sure she should go back to Chicago." And so the simplest solution was we got married. You know, that's what we do. You know, we look for a solution that works so we can continue being who we are. And who I was somebody who liked to drink. I didn't have to go to school anymore. I could just be a housewife and drink, I thought. Well, it didn't quite work out that way, but we got married. I should stay here now. For those that don't know you, me, I have been widowed 3 times, once in my 20s, once in my 40s, and once in my 60s. So you can, but it's just part of life. You know, I got gifts from all three of those people. My first husband didn't drink. He really liked drugs. And that made us the perfect match. I never touched his stuff. He never touched mine. I thought we were going to be happy forever. Now, my drinking continues to progress while I'm doing all these life events. And so I have this first child, just shy of 2 years of being married. My son Patrick is born. And back then, they had a special occasion that they would give the couple, the new parents. And you got this dinner the night before. You're in the hospital 5 days. That's unheard of now, but that was what was traditional then. And the night before you went home, they made this little candlelight dinner in your room with tablecloths and all this sort of jazz, and they served wine. And that was to help new mothers relax a little bit so that it made it easier for breastfeeding later. So this bottle of wine comes in with the dinner, and kids are okay. Must be okay. And so my husband didn't drink, so I drank his, I drank mine, and we went home the next day, and I figured it must be okay to drink while you're breastfeeding, you know, who knows. So fast forward 14 months later, I'm back in the same hospital having my second child. I did say we were Irish Catholics, right? And so I'm having my second child. We're having the second dinner. I know what to expect. So I drink the bottle of wine before my husband ever shows up. He shows up, goes out and tells them, "We didn't get a bottle of wine. They didn't deliver it." So we get the second bottle of wine. I drink both those glasses. And then when he's going home that night, I say, "You should tell them they should give us a bottle to go since we had to wait for the first one." That is the progression of alcoholism. In 15 months, I went from, I'm going to have his and mine, and then went on with my life, to I want his and mine and yours, and let's get some more for the road just in case. You know, it's not that far to my house, but just in case. So I had my progression of my alcoholism, and it's made me realize, like 3 or 4 days later, I was like, that's odd. You know, I'm 21. And my husband had had a series of attempted suicides in the years we were married. And so it was thought best that one of us work. So I went to get a job, and I happened to have some political family. And so I was offered a job working for the Secretary's office, the Department of Motor Vehicles, it's called most places. But my job was a hearing officer, and so I handled drunk drivers, accidents without suspension, anybody that was trouble on the highway, they were mine. I had 20 questions to hand out to all my clients. They took the quiz. I decided whether I thought they were alcoholic or not. They brought their sponsors in with them to show me how well they're doing and going to meetings and getting well, and they should get a driver's license back. Not once did it occur to me that I would have flunked my own test. Didn't happen. Fortunately, I had an Eskimo. One of my clients had worked 4 years to get his driver's license back. And he finally got it back. And going out the door, he and his sponsor say to me, "So have you ever been to AA?" "No, of course not. Why would I go to AA?" And they said, "Well, you'd be a much better employee if you went to 3 meetings." That felt like a challenge, you know? So I said, "Okay, I'll go to 3 meetings." I'd love to say the next 3 Saturday night speakers, I was right there front and center. It took me almost 6 months to get to 3 meetings because I would get off at 4:30 and the meeting started at 8 and I would stop at the bar thinking I'll get there and I would never get there. Finally, these guys would pick me up and take me to dinner to make sure I would get to that meeting. I still didn't think I had a problem. I had no idea. So I go to my first meeting, and I'm not really paying attention. I'm just there saying hello to clients. I'm sure now when I look at it, I'm sure they thought it was hysterical that I was at their meeting, but I thought I was just being there, you know. I go to the second meeting, and this old codger there, and he's going on and on and on and on. And then he says, "You know, you could be an alcoholic and not even realize it." He's pointing at me. I'm like, "Well, what does he know?" He said, "We have a 20 questions that anybody can take." And I'm thinking, "Oh, I know those 20 questions. He said, "I think everybody over the age of 20 should take that quiz at some point and see where they are with their alcohol." After the meeting, he came up to me and handed me the 20 questions. I said, "Oh, I'm quite familiar with it." He said, "Have you taken the questions?" I said, "No." He said, "Take one home for yourself." I took it home and I put it in my purse and I ignored it. You know, I'm busy, I'm working, I got 2 kids, I got a husband, da-da-da-da-da. I go to the last of my 3 meetings, finally, which was months later. That same guy is there. He said, "Did you take the quiz?" I had completely forgotten that he wanted a response. I said, "No." He said, "Okay." So I sat down and I listened. And the third speaker was somebody who told my story. Told exactly how I felt. How I was so empty inside. How in spite of the fact of looking happily married with 2 kids and a house in the suburbs, I just wanted to die. I couldn't live this way anymore. Drinking didn't help. It made it go away. I used to call it my vacation because I didn't expect it to fix anything. All it did was just make it go away for a little while. And then, of course, you come to and it's worse. And when that person told my story, I was stunned because I never would have thought I was alcoholic. But that person was. And then if he was, I had to think, well, maybe I should take the quiz. So I went home, and the next week I took the quiz, but I wouldn't mark the score. No fear of being honest here. So I take the quiz, I leave it on top of the table, I'm not going to mark it, I don't care. I took the quiz, that's what he asked me to do. And I went to a bar on a Saturday night. It's like 2 in the morning. And you know, it's a cop's bar. Because that's what I did for a living, was hang out with cops. And so I'm at this bar, and this guy's drinking ginger ale and orange juice at like 2:30 in the morning. And I just looked at him, and I said, you know, if you're drinking ginger and orange juice, you don't belong here. He said, if you know that, you probably don't belong here either. And so he invited me out for breakfast to talk. And I went. I don't know why I went, but I went. 5 hours later, he returned to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went to my first meeting. I've never seen that person at any meeting ever again. And I just think, thank you. You guys are there. So that was how I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. But you know what? I think about Alcoholics Anonymous and how much it's been in my life so much. My husband and I had, a third sober baby, because that's what a lot of people do when they're newly sober. And so shortly thereafter, he committed suicide successfully. So now I have 3 kids, 3 and under. And I'm newly sober, and yikes. And people in AA just stepped up. I had dated another one of my clients, and his girlfriend babysat my kids so that I could go to a meeting. I mean, really? But that's what you guys did. You did whatever it took to help me be successful. I stayed sober, but I didn't really believe I was alcoholic. I really wasn't sure. I couldn't find any of my family, and I thought, if this is a family disease, where are they? I didn't think I was really alcoholic. I thought I was like an Irish heavy social drinker, you know, without the social. But I didn't believe it, and so I stayed here. I got a sponsor. I worked steps. I did everything I was supposed to do. But I had that little reservation. And I'm very fortunate that where I got sober, they would call you on it. And so almost every, and I would talk about it in meetings that I wasn't sure. And they would say, well, step up to your local bar and try some controlled drinking. A good case of the jitters, yada, yada. They did that for almost 5 years. And When my husband had passed away, I went to a therapist, and she said, Marita, it can take up to 5 years to get settled into a new change. This is a big new change for you to be a widow. So I decided to give AA 5 years, too. And so at 4 years, 11 months, and 2 weeks, I don't know what I got mad at. I have no idea. But I thought, today's a good day to find out if I'm really alcoholic. And so with just that kind of a flippant attitude, I picked up a drink. I didn't drink long, about 3.5 weeks. I went from a periodic drinker to an all-day drinker. And at the end of that 3.5 weeks, I bought a gun and 1 bullet. I still think about that man in that store who would be willing to sell me 1 bullet, not a box. You know, there's still a lot of work we can do on CPC, and it's not just doctors. But it was fortunate that I also had the home group that not only did they tell me I need to step out and try some drinking, they also called me. Somebody from my home group called me every day just to see how I was. Nobody said anything about me drinking. They just, how are you? How are the kids? How's life? But that fateful day, they called and they said, how are you? And I said, I don't think I'm so good. I said, I bought a gun. I can't live like this anymore. They said, oh. And then they said the magic words. Do you think it could be your drinking? I have to tell you that alcohol is so powerful in my life that within 3 weeks of returning to drinking, I completely forgot that I wanted to see if I could drink socially. that I was completely in the grips of alcoholism. And I said, oh, crap, I think I am. And so I went back to meetings. It's not a big dramatic story for anybody else but me, because it's mine. I got active in my group, and there was this little Hispanic man who used to say, sit right here. And so I would sit there, because I was terrified of everybody anyway. And so I would sit there, and then one day I had about 8 months of sobriety, and they were looking for an alternate GSR. And Oscar, turned out, was the GSR. He said, we have one. I picked her out. I'm oblivious, and I'm listening, and he says, yeah, Marita can do it. I'm thinking, really? I said, oh, I'd love to. You know, the automatic lie response. I'm so polite. Oh, I would just love to, but I have 3 children at home. I don't have another person who can help me. He said, no, 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 no. My wife will watch your children. We've already talked about it. So this darling Hispanic man took me home to meet his wife, who didn't speak English, and she taught my children remedial Spanish, and I joined General Service. So I went to my first meeting, and it was an assembly, and the most amazing thing was, is they were talking about, they were changing the book. Now, I have finally decided I like AA, I'm going to stay in AA, and what do you mean you're changing our book? I went rushing back to my home group and said, they're changing our book. And they said, what are you talking about? They said so at the assembly. And of course, Oscar's sitting there laughing at me, basically. But I said, yeah, they said they're going to change our big book. And they said, oh, you better go keep an eye on them and let us know what's going on. I went back to General Service. They were changing the stories from the second edition to the third edition, but I didn't know enough to know that. And as a side, I just have to say that when I got to serve as a trustee on our board, I had the opportunity to chair the literature committee for the trustees' literature committee while we worked on the fifth edition. And I thought, I hope there's somebody in some assembly out there that's going, they changing our book. We can kind conflict whether there is any or not, you know? So I stayed in General Service, and I stayed in AA. I got remarried, and the most amazing thing happened. We got transferred to Saudi Arabia. Ha! Huh, surprise! And so my husband, who had 10 years more sobriety than I did, said, well, there's only one thing we have to check before I say yes. And I said, okay, what's that? He said, I have to make sure they have meetings. Good plan, you know. That's the importance of marrying well. You know, they remember that stuff. And so we went to New York. We thought it was important to go to our General Service office to say goodbye and see it before we left and pick up extra literature. So we do all that. And it turns out that this darling woman gave us a little tour. And at the end, she pats me on the arm and she says, now you keep in touch. I thought she meant it literally. Every 6 months, I wrote a report. 19 people in AA, 6 are British, 2 are German, 3 American. I'm sure she could have cared less. But she kept in touch. She sent me literature. And she was my roommate at the International Convention this past year, because that's how we make AA friends. I love Susan. But you know, my sobriety is just my sobriety. What is important is Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the miracle to me. Not that I'm sober. That's a miracle for me. But it's Alcoholics Anonymous that's the miracle. And you know, I wouldn't have gotten sober except that somebody did CPC at some point and got those pamphlets into the office that I took over when I went to work for the Secretary of State's office. I got to hand out 20 questions because somebody gave them to somebody in the DMV so that I could hand them out. I got to Saudi Arabia with phone numbers in my hand because we had a general service office that collected phone numbers back then around the world of people who lived all over the world so we could find each other. We got shipments of delivery of literature from the office in Great Britain, from Germany, and the United States to make sure that we all could carry the message in the languages that we needed in our little group. Everywhere I have gone, Alcoholics Anonymous has been there first. I didn't have to do any of the hard work. I just have to pass it on and keep it going. So my husband and I, we lived in 8 states and 4 foreign countries. It's really an embarrassment of stories, but AA was in all of them. AA was already there waiting for us, just scooped us up, took us in, and said, "Yay! We got another one." When we moved to California, we finally decided that we needed to go ahead and pay back General Service. Because we're always trying to pay back to AA, but General Service people made our life easy by being there first, by providing the literature, by carrying the message. And so we joined our General Service, and you know, I did the traditional route of almost everybody in the room. I was a reluctant alternate GSR, a confused GSR, an overwhelmed DCM. I mean, we all do it. I think DCM is the hardest job there is in Alcoholics Anonymous because you have to take people who aren't sure what their role is and explain to them people who know too much about their role and make it interesting enough that their group will care. God bless our DCMs and DCMCs. So we made a deal when we moved to California that we would never leave the region because we like to move a lot. But we did manage to stay in one place for 15 years. And so my husband Steve and I were able to go through General Service in Area 5. Yes. And so it was a lot bigger back then. It was a lot bigger. And so we went through General Service, and I had the honor and the privilege of serving as a delegate, and my husband served as a delegate, and then we moved to Nevada. And I thought I would sit in the back of the room. And I actually, if you met my husband, Steve, you would have said, "Oh, he's going to be such a great trustee." I mean, everybody loved the way his heart worked. And I really think the wife of a trustee is the best job in Alcoholics Anonymous. You can do all the traveling and none of the work. God had other plans. I became a widow in my 40s. Steve got sick one weekend and died the following weekend, and I was surprised, and so was he. And so I have 3 children, and my youngest has a lot of special needs, and I thought, okay, I'm kind of done. You know, maybe I'll get to assemblies, and maybe not. But, you know, Colleen and I will have a happy life because you guys gave me one. And so that was in 2000. I did. I had a really happy life. I sat in the back of the assembly of whichever area I was in. I mean, I used to call myself the regional past delegate because I lived in 5, 93, 9, 41, and thought about 8 because I was there twice a month for meetings. And I thought, you know, that's who I am. I'm the regional past delegate. I move a lot, but I stay in the region. And so I didn't put my name forward for anything. I just stayed home. And then I got remarried to a past trustee. I missed the travel, but he was just such an incredible man. And he and I had known each other over 20 years. I knew his wife, he knew my husband. They had a standing joke about the car that my husband drove. My husband cherished his Volvo. That was all he ever drove, were Volvos. And Julian used to say, oh, look, it's a Ford, because Ford bought Volvo. And so they would have running jokes for years. And so Julian and I got married, and I moved back to Nevada. I thought we would have a happy, happy life. And about 2.5 years in, he got diagnosed with cancer and said, we're not telling nobody about this stuff. And I thought, oh, I understand how that works. Look at me on crutch, on a cane. I'm fine. You want a wheelchair? No, I'm fine. So I understood Julian. My beautiful son gave me a platter one Christmas, and he said, your plate's too full. You've got a special needs daughter. You have a husband with cancer. You're new back in the state again. I want to get something off your plate, and took over the conservatorship of his sister. You guys, you taught me how to be the parent that creates a child who thinks like that. I mean, that was such an incredible, awesome gift that he gave me. So we did it, and he lives in Utah, and my daughter lives nearby him, and he has 6 kids, and so their house is always busy, so she's always busy, and it's perfect. It's so much better than living with your old mom, you know. So now Julian passes away, and I'm just sitting here. Now, I told you that Scott and Nancy and I were all delegates together in 1999 when the dinosaurs roamed the earth, but Nancy knew my sponsor, Jackie, really well. And Jackie had this way of just kind of putting her finger in your chest when she was talking to you in case you didn't get the message. And Nancy called me one day and she said, do you feel Jackie's finger in your chest? I'm like, no, Jackie died 20 years ago. Yeah. No, I don't feel that. And she said, are you sure? Jackie used to always say, when I was appointed area secretary, and after the 15 months I served, I said, I don't like podiums. I don't even have to read names. I'm happier in the back of the room. I don't think this is for me. And she went, oh, as only past trustees do. Oh, really? You know, we've already invested an awful lot of time and money in you. We'll tell you when you're done. We'll just vote no. And so Nancy reminded me that you hadn't voted no. And so I said, okay, and I looked, and there was a trustee at large position that was open, and the next year was going to be regional. And I looked at it, and I thought, well, it's been 20 years since I've been delegate. Nobody really knows who I am anymore. And I thought, oh, there's 89 candidates possibly for trustee at large, where there's only 15 if it's a regional. I'm going with the trustee at large because my odds of going home are so much better. And so I put my name in for trustee at large. I was supposed to get a dog, and my friend said, don't get the dog till after the conference. And I'm like, really? Come on. And Wednesday of conference week, Julie, our then delegate from Nevada, called me up, and all the regional delegates yelled in the phone, don't get the dog! Trustee at large travels. I traveled every 3 to 4 weeks. I was on the road somewhere. There are 21 trustees, sometimes 22, on our General Service Board. There is one that's the trustee at large U.S. and one that's the trustee at large Canada. And they are the candidates that go and become our representative to the World Service Meeting. And they are also the people that get invited around the world to represent the alcoholics of U.S. and Canada. Sometimes it's because the structure's new and they have questions on how should we do this and what about that. Sometimes it's to celebrate an anniversary of a country that they're so excited they want the mothership to send somebody to join them in their celebration. And you guys gave me the opportunity to do that for 4 years. I got to go to Cuba, where they had the Ministry of Mental Health come and recognize Alcoholics Anonymous after 22 years. They said, "We've been watching." That makes my heart scared every time I think of that. "We have been watching you for 22 years. And we think that Alcoholics Anonymous is the only thing that gets people sober and returns them to be healthy and active family and community members." I just think that's a credible testament to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got to go to Mongolia for their 25th anniversary, and what was really fun was I actually happened to have been in Mongolia 25 years beforehand. Their meeting was 3.5 weeks old when I went. I went on business, and I went to a meeting because that's what I do when I travel. I go to meetings. I want to find my family. And so I had gone to this meeting, and it was in a psychiatric hospital, and, you know, it was kind of fumbly, and it was in a foreign language, and I didn't really care. I was just happy to sit with my people. So I got to go back for their 25th anniversary, and there was the psychiatrist who started Alcoholics Anonymous in Mongolia. And I have to tell you, the Mongolians, they are party people. They sent buses all over the country to pick up all the alcoholics that could come. And they had hundreds and hundreds of people that all came. Some of them brought food, some didn't bring food. Everybody got fed, everybody took care of each other, and just celebrated sobriety. Just stunning. And the reason why they have it in Mongolia is pure happenstance. That psychiatrist got trained in Russia when people brought the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to Russia. And some instructor in the medical school told the students, "If you go, I will give you extra credit." And a psychiatrist student went. And then the rest of his time in medical school, he saw what happened to people who got sober. He took that Russian big book home to Mongolia, translated it, and began AA. The friends of Alcoholics Anonymous are just incredible for us. I just don't want to harm that relationship that we have with the world, because it's amazing what they do. I think Henrietta Seiberling, we wouldn't exist without her. Another non-alcoholic. Sister Ignatia. I can go on, which is why we had to read Dr. Jack Naris, because another non-alcoholic. I can go on and on and on about the people I have met because you trusted me when I thought you were changing my book. And yet here I stand at the full circle of that. My home group took care of me. At my last conference, they decided, while I of course wasn't there, that I should be elected treasurer of my home group. And so they elected me in absentia. We have 42 meetings a week. It's 6 different fellowships, and they all put their money in the same box. Okay, you know, I've been in general service a while. I know that the GA, the NA, the ACA, all those Al-Anon, they don't belong in the same box. So I had to go around and visit all these different fellowships and explain, "I don't want all your money." And they're like, "It's $4. And I'm like, "Nope. I get 2, you get 2. And as a result, I had the opportunity to do workshops in my little town of Mesquite, 20,000 people, teaching our traditions to other fellowships and what that seventh tradition means about being fully self-supporting, how they have to contribute to their fellowships. And I thought, wow, this is a big deal because those envelopes fill up quick. And so that wasn't enough. God sent me two brand new, never been to AA before newcomers. I got sober in 1981. It's probably been 25 years since I've had a brand new newcomer. I get people who move into town or somebody who sponsors passed away or what. You know, they've all been through the steps a while. I'm exhausted. These gals have got me running. I go to like three times more meetings than I was going to before. They're at my house. Now, we have a regular schedule where they're supposed to come, but they're showing up all these other times, too, because they're having crises, you know? The joy that you have given me in my life is immeasurable. When people say, how have you done with rotation? I think, it was easy. The conference elected a woman who's fabulous, probably going to be much better than I was at this last gig I had. But I got to come home and sit in my chair in my home group and hang out with my people. I haven't been able to go to all the processes in the last 4 years, and I missed the regional forum, not this one, but the one before. I don't have any excuses anymore. I am so excited to be back in the loving embrace of my region. Thank you.